Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, Senior Security Analyst at WatchGuard Threat Lab. And today, as usual, I'll be joined by our CTO, Corey Knockreiner, but we also have a special guest today, Mr. Ryan Orsi. Say hi, Ryan.
Hi, Ryan.
Well done. Ryan is our resident wireless security expert. We actually have a fun section interviewing him about wireless security, why it matters, and what can I do as an individual or organization to keep my wireless airspace safe. Before that, though, we'll dive into some news topics, specifically the latest indictments on 12 Russian intelligence hackers that went after the DNC and the DCCC and how they did it. Stay tuned. So for today's news, we're actually going to talk about something that happened the day after we recorded our last podcast. We just missed the cut on this one. And it involves the 12 indicted Russian intelligence officers that were accused of hacking the DNC and the DCCC.
What, Mark? The Russians, I just don't see why they would hack the DNC. Oh, wait. I mean, I wouldn't.
Yes.
I don't see why they wouldn't hack.
Get
Let
it
me
right.
make that clear.
Come on. Yes. We need to make sure we're talking clearly here and we don't have to go back and retract our words. Ignoring as much as we can the politics around it, the indictment that the indictment that was released actually had quite a bit of details about the hacks that went on in order to basically fish and compromise the networks of the DNC and the DCCC.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal. I mean, for a long time, we talked about allegedly Russia did this. Security people talked about this a long time ago, but alphabet agencies often don't share any evidence. Why? More for, you know, secrecy, not letting out any of their tools, tactics, and procedures. But in this case, there's actually quite a bit of specific things that the attackers did that really highlight to the world that, you know, it seems pretty clear this was Russian actors.
Yeah. So in the indictment, they have a section in there that goes over step by step what these intelligence agents went through in order to hack into these networks. It started around March 2016, and then it only took until April 2016 when they actually had a foothold in the DNC and the DCCC. They went over the...
Did you already say, by the way, for the people that don't know, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and the Democratic National Committee,
correct,
for those out there that don't know acronymies?
Let's just acronymize the rest of this podcast.
We're security experts. We're good at that.
So they also went into the fake personas that the intelligence operatives came up with in order to disseminate their stolen data, the Guccifer 2 and the DC leaks, individuals that turn out to not be individuals. But
surprise, surprise.
Yes, yeah, surprise, surprise. The most interesting bit, though, came from the actual details around the hack. So throughout the attacks, they started with spear phishing emails, or at least it's labeled as spear phishing.
Yeah, I would argue that some of them don't even qualify with the spear. You know, I think everyone knows phishing are pretty massly sent emails that don't have a lot of customized detail to lure you. Rather, they're just generic, like this is a Google security issue or you're missing your UPS package.
Right.
Whereas spear phishing tries to maybe incorporate something specific about you and may even use some one you know.
And so the first bout of emails in this case were just basically emails spoofed to look like a Google security notification.
I guess they were spear phishing only in that I think they started by targeting 300 individuals. So they weren't sending them massively on the internet, but it was a basic, you know, notification of your password needing a reset type email, which is kind of old school phishing in my opinion.
Old school, but it works. Clearly.
Absolutely. And if there's any takeaway here, it's that even the most basic human social engineering tactic worked against people that worked at least indirectly for government associations.
And these initial emails really ticked all of the phishing 101 checkboxes too. They used URL shorteners to mask the links back to the Russian intelligence-owned servers. They spoofed the message, used real assets to make it look like a Google-generated message. The stuff that we see every day in the phishing emails that we encounter.
And I think, well, when we start about them talking about the malware they delivered, even the malware's tactics and what it does is pretty similar to criminal malware. You know, it's not all that different.
They did step up their game a little bit with some of the phishing emails. They used some targeted spear phishing emails later on. where they actually copied an email account with just a single letter spelling deviation from an actual employee of the Clinton campaign in this case.
So, and to be clear, the victim is receiving an email from someone they think they know, yep. which makes it more targeted.
Exactly. And it included a link to a document titled Hillary Clinton Favorable Rating, an Excel yeah. file.
I'm going to open that if I work for the DNC.
And again, it worked.
Yeah. It probably also convinced all the Democrats out there that she'd win. Lo and behold.
So the end result of these phishing emails, though, they were able to compromise several accounts and basically gain valid credentials that they could then use to directly attack the networks.
Yep.
Before they went after the DCCC, though, they actually did another thing that cyber criminals commonly do and did reconnaissance to try and find holes to punch in. So the indictment spells out they did a technical query for internet protocol configurations of the DCCC network.
Sounds like NMAP to me.
Yeah, it sounds like they ran just a port scan to see what services were running. It also notes they used open source information to try and figure out the configuration of the internals of the DCCC network. So again, just common
Hacker 101. I mean, yeah. I think we have something called What's in a Hacker's Toolkit, old webinar series I did, and the whole reconnaissance effort is basically just this, a mix of what you call passive reconnaissance, which you're not doing anything, you're not touching their computers, but you're looking at these quote-unquote open source information stores.
Searching Shodan.
Websites. Shodan does a port scan in a way, so
but
I would consider what it does
yes.
is open source, what you're doing when you look at Shodan. But I mean even more looking at Facebook connections, you know, things that don't have to touch the network, whereas the more active reconnaissance are the port scans, the vulnerability scans. Shodan, like you say, when you're using Shodan, you're being passive, but I would argue it's technically taking advantage of an active.
That's fair.
Yeah.
So once they finished their reconnaissance, though, the indictment notes that they then gained access to the DCCC network.
Yep.
They're a little light on the details on this. My assumption is that some of those credentials were probably capable to be used with a VPN.
I also believe a phishing email even had a link in it. And I read something about a phishing email having a link that led to the first installation of what we'll talk about, X-Agent,
yeah.
which is a piece of malware. And that right away would give you an in where you could then go after the internal network and do the lateral movement and pivoting.
Yeah. So once on the network, however they managed to get in, they installed what they call, what the indictment calls the X-Agent malware. And in reality, it's actually a fairly simple Trojan.
It sounds like a bot
place.
Client or a Trojan.
Yeah.
Monitors activity,
key
captures
logging,
keystrokes,
screen capturing,
passwords.
Yep. File searching. And then it also connected back home to a command and control server that in this case, the indictment says was in the state of Arizona.
Well, yeah, a mix. I think they did like a lot of smart criminals. They did a bit of proxying. Didn't they bounce to what they call middle servers overseas, but then back to the...
A few weeks into the attack, the indictment notes that they set up or they tested first a new proxy server in another location and then bounced their connections to the command and control server through that proxy. And we see this a lot with cyber attacks where... especially nation-state attacks where the people in charge of it go to great lengths to mask where they are coming from.
That's why attribution is typically hard, and it's why we typically say allegedly,
right?
Because you never know what they're bouncing through, so you have to find other things. They're also smart, like a lot of criminals, in that this wasn't stagnant malware. Once they installed it, I believe between April and June, they also updated this agent on computers regularly to add new capabilities, just take advantage of things. And I think all smart criminals do that. You see new variants of ransomware or Trojans or bots all the time, adding a new module to do something or changing something to get past some sort of new security mechanism.
They even had a secondary piece of malware that's called X-Tunnel that they used for exfiltrating the data back out of the networks because they were able to gather gigabytes worth of documents and emails from compromised workstations on this network. And trying to get that out of a network could set off alarm
flags. Yep.
So securely and secretly exfiltrating out of the network is a very important step to a successful attack, I suppose. But either way, I think it was the end of May is when the DCCC and the DNC noted that they had been the victim of a cyber attack and they started investigating it.
Yeah, but it does also look like the attackers tried to clean up too, right? Yeah. I mean, they unlike typical automated malware, there were some logs and files deleted. I think they even used an over-the-shelf product, in fact, one that was hijacked last year, to help clean up some stuff.
Yeah, CCleaner. The indictment notes that they tried to use CCleaner to clean up their malware on these infected workstations.
Yeah.
They didn't get everything, though. The company that the DNC brought in to investigate the hack was able to find several malware samples, including ones that were configured with Russian-known domain names to call home to command and control. One thing I actually forgot to note in here is the hack of the DNC occurred coming from the DCCC.
Yeah.
So they didn't attack the DNC directly. They were able to gain access through the DCCC's network.
Lateral movement.
And we see this a lot. I mean, this is how Target got breached. They didn't go directly after Target. They went after their HVAC provider. And then through that partner / vendor, they were able to access the main network.
It's a type of privilege escalation attack. If you can get the privileges of someone your victim trusts, in this case, the DCCC, that might give you a little more privilege on another network. By the way, ultimately, I'm not sure if we said it, but I think it was something like 10 computers at least in the DCCC and 30 devices in the DNC that actually had this malware on it for sure.
A still sizable number for these organizations.
You really don't need many more. I mean, no. It doesn't take that many lateral moves until you hit pay dirt in a normal attack.
One of the things I actually found really interesting in this whole indictment paper was they went over how they managed to pay for all of these servers and domain registrations.
I would argue this is what makes them more sophisticated. All malware uses a certain type of malware and has a command and control, but the effort you put into hiding how those middleman servers get purchased or get owned is part of hiding who you are.
So in this case, they set up individual identities for almost every single service they registered for. Fake identities. One of them was some fake lady in New York.
There were people that traveled to the U.S. to set up these accounts and identities and to pay using things like...
And then in the pay, they used Bitcoin. So cryptocurrency was the majority of the facility used to fund all of these servers and domain registrations.
I think that's something cyber criminals sometimes miss is good OPSEC, operational security. Yep. It's not just about the technical things in your malware evading technical security controls, but making sure all the production chain or the attack chain of what servers you connect to, that you paid for them using anonymous methods, that you really made sure that your identity is protected as you set up this attack. And these attackers were probably better than the average Joe at that.
I'd imagine. You would think as
Maybe if you worked for the GRC or the FSB and were trained by Russian agents, you should have decent OPSEC, I would imagine.
You would think. So they acquired the Bitcoin using ways you might think, buying it. But one thing that the indictment noted that I found very interesting was they actually mined their own Bitcoin in order to try and pay for some of these services, which is, I mean, I hate to admit it, something I hadn't really thought about before where
you can leave a paper trail when you go purchase
Bitcoin, but if you mine it, it's much easier to hide your identity in this case.
And by the way, there's dedication. It takes some time to mine Bitcoin now at these values.
Yep. But it makes sense. It's a great way to mask your trail.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, this, yeah.
Makes you think about all those huge mining farms in China now.
I wonder.
What other nation states have hacking red teams?
Not China.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm sure China would. I don't see why they would hack us, Mark.
No, not possible.
Oh, wait, did I mean Wooden again? I think I meant Wooden again.
I mean, with that, what takeaways can we have for this one?
I think phishing is the first one. I mean, we talk all about it. Here at WatchGuard, we have a lot of technical security controls that are great. We have a new one called DNS Watch that is all about making sure your users, if they do click on a phishing or spear phishing email, they can't get to the link. But the even better part of that product is when a user does click on it, we're going to forward them to like a phishing video to talk about spear phishing. We can fix every single technical problem in our networks. Imagine we had perfect source code. There's zero computer vulnerabilities in source. Imagine everyone followed every best practice and had every network security control down. They would still have users that clicked on things they shouldn't. So really, I think people should focus on phishing awareness training. And even though, you know, ironically, it didn't really take spear phishing during the first emails to get these folks, talk about spear phishing training. It's much harder to identify a spear phish email because they will look like normal business correspondence. And it's okay if your boss sends you an email with a document and asks you to open it and make a payment or to text him or text you asking for a money file or a money wire transfer, it's totally okay to talk to your boss in person and ask him, are you sure?
Is this for real?
Yeah, yeah. So focus on the spear phishing part. I think that's a simple takeaway that, you know, every business from the biggest three-letter alphabet agency to the smallest mom-and-pop faux shop could take into account.
Yeah, and I mean, we really are seeing a lot of attacks start with spear phishing emails these days.
Yep.
The stats around it, I saw.
I think it's like 91% of targeted breaches are spear phishing based.
So having good phishing education is critical for any organization's cyber defenses.
Absolutely. And by the way, it seems like this is the world we live in. We've talked about nation state actors. I obviously don't love this sort of thing, but you could argue that us doing Stuxnet was a similar thing, even though we feel like maybe it's the side of good to stop nuclear weapon propagation. You know, should nation states really be participating in these red team offensive cyber attacks? I personally believe I want my government to focus on defense and closing down any hole that can allow for this type of thing, rather than saving zero-day stockpiling vulnerabilities that they can use against others.
Well,
but that's my personal belief.
It doesn't matter what you want. They're going to do it anyway.
That's probably true, but that's why we need the defense.
Yep, I agree. So now that we've caught the hackers, we're safe, right?
Oh, yeah, we totally are.
Yeah. So nothing else to worry about then.
Well, I guess the other big thing in this is, you know, even if you're a huge enterprise or you're an organization that somehow is associated with security, it probably doesn't mean you have perfect security. You know, it is very surprising to see government organizations get hacked. So I think even a normal business can use this to make sure that they're not lulled into a sense of everything's safe, because I'm sure our enterprise security guy has this taken care of.
Yeah, I agree. Those are some great tips. So I guess we'll continue to follow this one as it goes.
Great story, Mark.
Cheers. So today I'm joined by Mr. Ryan Orsi, our resident Wi-Fi expert. Ryan, you want to introduce yourself?
Is that what I'm known as?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah, everybody. I'm Ryan Orsi. Hi, Mark. Good to see you, buddy.
Hi, Ryan.
Hello. I've been leading the Wi-Fi charge here for the past couple of years and diving deep into the topic of security and wireless.
So, I mean, I want to start out with Wi-Fi hacking. Is it real? Is it all hype? Is it something we have to worry about? What are your thoughts on this?
Hocus pocus, sorcery, magicians. I'm just kidding. I guess I'd be out of a job in that case. No, thankfully for my wife and family, I'm happily employed because there are a ton of hacks around Wi-Fi going on in the world every single day. The thing is, not many people are aware of, when you say the word hack and Wi-Fi, those two words together, what you're actually talking about. So good topic to dig into today.
Yeah. So what are we talking about? What do, like, the everyday person, what do they have to be concerned about when it comes to wireless security?
Fundamentally, the one thing I tell, you know, friends, family, colleagues, is between your phone, your laptop, whatever you have that's quote unquote, you know, your Wi-Fi client, and what the other side, right? You are on Wi-Fi, you're connected to some access point or home router or whatever it may be. That link is wireless. And Wi-Fi 802.11, since its inception, is kind of flawed in some ways. It's also very, very successful, of course, because we all know what Wi-Fi is. But that connection can be eavesdropped. So it kind of anybody, bad, you know, gray hat, bad people like us, can go sniff packets.
Hey, speak for yourself.
Maybe I shouldn't be color coding you just yet, right? That's I go too far.
I keep my hat hidden. You don't know.
Oh, geez. But yeah, anybody really with a few minutes on YouTube can figure out how to steal whatever you're doing on Wi-Fi, right? If you're browsing a website, we'll figure out what website you're browsing. If you're typing in your credit card number and you think you're on HTTPS, perhaps you're actually not, and we can grab things like that. So just that direction, right, from, say, the phone up to the access point is pretty wide open.
So even with when I go to a coffee shop, sometimes I have to put in a password. Does that not keep me safe?
Oh, okay. So the passwords on Wi-Fi, and many times when we talk about Wi-Fi security, everyone's mind goes to, hey, a password. A password on Wi-Fi on the SSID is assigning, you know, a type of encryption protocol on that link. WPA2 is the current highest encryption standard that we have for most of those open, not public hotspots. It's not infallible, right? Last year, that encryption protocol was broken in a hack known as the key reinstallation attack, or crack.
Crack.
Crack is whack.
Not
Mark.
Even once.
and that has been proven to be, you know, bypassed not so easily, right? It's still a fairly good standard encryption protocol. One serious vulnerability in over a decade is not too bad.
Right, but that was a fundamental flaw in the protocol itself.
It freaked a lot of people out.
Right.
Myself included, right? We got the inside track being a security vendor in the Wi-Fi space, and we realized very quickly we'd have to be patching our own gear and protecting our customers and clients out there in the wild of WatchGuard Wireless. But yeah, it did have quite a big impact and has led the Wi-Fi Alliance to reevaluate Wi-Fi encryption protocol completely.
Yeah, and even outside the protocol, just the use of passwords isn't always secure, right? So when you connect to your hotel Wi-Fi network and they have a password, or like the airport lounge in my example, you're entering a password and it is technically encrypted, your connection, but your encryption key is actually derived from that password itself, which means that everyone else that has a copy of that password, so anyone else that has visited the hotel or the airport lounge, can get your encryption key too.
You got it. That's and by the way, there's very easy to use successful services online that if you're able to capture that four-way handshake, that's a term between, you know, a series of packets sent between your client and the access point during a WPA2 association handshake exchange. There's four packets there. You grab those, you upload it to these, you know, cracking services. It's a all-you-can-eat kind of service. You pay a flat fee, and they will run a dictionary attack against that exchange until you get the password, even if it's not known. So both ways, you're not safe with just passwords, of course.
And this is assuming you're using WPA2. If you're still stuck in the dark ages and you're using WEP, it's even more easy, right?
Oh, what a foul term, WEP. Oh, people actually, it's funny you mentioned that. You know, the war driving site Wiggle still reports a very high percentage of SSIDs hotspots on the world using WEP protocol.
It's insane.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it is technically better than not being open, but I mean, not by a whole lot.
To right? You and I, nah, not really.
So, I mean, there are improvements to Wi-Fi security coming though, right?
There are, right? So coming off the heels of crack, the Wi-Fi Alliance is going to be releasing WPA. Can you guess what
Ooh.
Comes after two?
Two and a half?
Ah, negative. We're going all the way to three, buddy. We're going WPA 3 is a new encryption protocol for Wi-Fi that the Wi-Fi Alliance has standardized. It's going to be kind of packaged, we're thinking, from the vendor community with 802.11ax, a whole new Wi-Fi chipset. And that is quite a big deal for the industry. But remember, Mark, what does protecting one side of the equation do to a whole overall holistic security approach?
Exactly.
Nothing. Access points have to be connected to by our laptops and our smartwatches and your light bulbs and all those clients. And there's billions and billions of these clients out there that also would have to support WPA3 or some of the other Wi-Fi Alliance, security enhancements that they're bringing out. And typically, clients kind of trail the industry. They lag the industry. So if access points come out with something new and cool and fast, clients don't really come onto the scene with that technology to maybe 3 years past the introduction.
Even if the client itself can be updated, sometimes it takes a whole new version, like the MacBook 2019 probably will be the first one to support it.
You got it. We've talked about in other areas of our time together about IoT devices.
Yes.
And imagine all of those IoT devices that, you know, maybe can't be upgraded, or maybe using such an old chipset, it doesn't support this.
Yeah, it could be a huge issue. But there are, I mean, there are some good benefits coming with WPA3, right? So on the enterprise level, they're increasing the encryption levels. On the personal level, so what we would call pre-shared key, so WPA PSK, they're replacing it with something called WPA3 Personal, which adds some additional security benefits. Something I mentioned earlier, the whole, if an attacker has the password, they can decrypt any and all packets that were encrypted with that password. WPA3 Personal fixes that, right?
It does. It's going to patch those problems, absolutely.
Those specific problems.
Those specific ones, right.
They're also adding, it's not technically coupled with WPA3, but another standard that the Wi-Fi Alliance just put out was Enhanced Open, which, in my opinion, it's a bit of a stopgap for open networks. If you're not familiar with Enhanced Open, it uses something called opportunistic wireless encryption, where when a client connects to an open network, think Starbucks, there's the opportunity to set up encryption for that connection, but it still lacks authentication, which means it's not going to stop the bad guy from sitting there with fake Starbucks Wi-Fi from getting in the middle of your connection.
You just said the magic phrase, getting in the middle, yes, of the connection. Yeah, so OWE uses all sorts of really cool cryptography standards, which gets me all excited, but you're right. It's going to add encryption to open SSIDs, except now they're going to be called enhanced open SSIDs. Of course, the client has to support that as well. It will offer better confidence that eavesdropping can't happen as easily. So right. If you or I are in our coffee shop connected to the actual legitimate access point of the coffee shop, it's going to be a lot harder for anybody to eavesdrop on our open or enhanced open SSID connection. But if you or I fall for a good old trick of the trade in Wi-Fi hacking and we connect to an evil twin access point, right? So we don't realize it, right? We've connected to that coffee shop's SSID every morning. We come in one morning, our device still connects to the same SSID, but it's actually being broadcasted from an imposter nearby in the corner, you know, sipping some strange coffee drink, and they're running, you know, a little USB dongle with essentially an access point or an Android device, and they're just broadcasting the same SSID as the coffee shop. Our devices know no better, and they just associate to it automatically, and then you are being victimized by a man-in-the-middle attack. And we could still have an enhanced open connection, absolutely. We'll be exchanging cryptography keys with the evildoer.
So let's say, strictly for research purposes, someone wanted to learn how to perform these attacks. They wanted to know how to do an evil twin or man-in-the-middle attacks. Hmm. What would you instruct them to do, Mr. Orsi?
For research purposes, you say,
research,
right, Mark?
Purposes.
Okay, strictly for the sacred of science.
Yes.
There is a little website you might have heard of called YouTube. And, you know, I think this podcast will play minimized just fine, so you can still listen to our smooth jazz voices while you go to YouTube and search hack Wi-Fi or evil twin Wi-Fi.
That easy?
That easy, my man. There are tons and tons of videos. And, you know, the more sophisticated InfoSec people will take them to a whole nother level. But if you just want to get in the middle of someone's connection and sniff traffic, you know, see website history, browser history, it is pretty simple to do.
Is it expensive? Do I need expensive Wi-Fi hacking tools in order to do this?
Is this where I give my PayPal information? No, I'm just kidding. Absolutely not. There's not a lot of gear you need, right? I'm testing a tool right now on my laptop, right? There's nothing else required. It's a free open source software tool. There's a community, right, of pen testers out there that are willing to kind of, you know, commit to this project of making Wi-Fi safer. The downside, right, is that, of course, those tools are pretty powerful, and they can be misused by evildoers. There's things like the Wi-Fi Pineapple, which has made, you know, many, many strides over the years by Hack5, kind of leading the way of educating and on pen testing Wi-Fi. Some folks will use those in nefarious ways, and it's little devices that are, what, $99, I think, online last time I checked. And it'll automate the things we're talking about, you know, broadcasting a fake SSID, getting connections connected, sniffing traffic, injecting packets, putting up a splash page that looks legitimate but prompts people for email and password to fool them into it. So it's pretty accessible.
And all with what a fancy little GUI to go along with it too to set it up. So you don't even need huge amounts of skill, right?
That GUI is pretty beautiful. Yeah, yeah. You don't have to be a CLI expert anymore.
So, do you have any fun stories from the field? Any Wi-Fi attacks maybe you've seen or heard of happening before?
Oh, indeed. So if you know me around the WatchGuard circles, we do a lot of traveling around the world, educating, right? We don't do a lot of sales pitching here, but I educate people on Wi-Fi threats. And we'll fill a room of InfoSec people. And in a room, we'll sit them down under the table. We might be running something like a Wi-Fi pineapple or equivalent. It's just listening for all their phones, figuring out what kind of SSIDs they're all searching for. We get them all connected to our quote-unquote, you know, honeypot or evil twin access point. And during the presentation of us introducing different Wi-Fi threats like rogue access points and man-in-the-middle attacks on Wi-Fi, we throw up the beautiful GUI of that Wi-Fi pineapple, and we show people's phones names, right, and their SSIDs from their house or their office or the airplane that they flew into the event on that they're already connected to. We tell them, take your phone out. What SSID are you connected to right now?
Go in-flight in the middle of a Marriott.
It's a little suspicious, right?
These are security professionals, right?
They are, yes.
So if they can fall for it, it's an issue.
It's an issue. Yeah, it definitely is. And that happens all the time. We've done hundreds and hundreds of events around all parts of the world. So it's not any particular part of the world that's, you know, more educated on Wi-Fi security versus the others. It's pretty ubiquitous.
So if you had one request to make to those that are in charge of wireless security, the Wi-Fi Alliance perhaps, of a major change you think might help, what might you propose?
Given the folks in power, right, they'll say the Wi-Fi Alliance, from a consumer perspective, I feel like solving the issue of security can't put a lot of demand on them, right? We can't ask them to be downloading software and buying certain kinds of laptops to be safe. We need to do it at the infrastructure level, at the standards level. So I would ask that SSIDs have a verification way, like graphically on your laptop. When you see that SSID drop down, it has a little padlock on it. You know it's got a password. It's encrypted. I'd like to see a different padlock that says that icon that distinguishes that SSID as one that's protected with wireless intrusion prevention system, a WIP system, to actually detect these kinds of nefarious hacks and block and prevent them.
That's a good idea. Something similar to HTTPS for verifying SSIDs and verifying they're secure.
You know, I never thought of it that way, Mark. That's actually pretty clever, man. Yeah, something visual, right, that you can see.
Got to go find our patent lawyer.
That's it. Where is he?
So we've talked a lot about consumer protection. What if I run IT for an organization and we have a wireless network, as almost every single company nowadays does? What do I need to be concerned about?
You mean you don't run cable everywhere, Mark? Really? You have Wi-Fi in your office? Yeah, so from the business side, right, from more of the corporate view, if you're in IT or you're a business owner and you have Wi-Fi in your business, it's not always a hacker you have to be worried about, right? There's Wi-Fi security threats related to being next door to people that might be trying to connect to your Wi-Fi. They see it available, right? If you're in a shared building and people next door to you can see your signal, your SSID, whether it's guest or private, maybe they have the password. You never know. How do you actually prevent those people that should not be on your network, right? Like, you would never give them an Ethernet cable and say, go ahead and plug in, you know, have access to my file server. That's what you're doing with Wi-Fi in like a shared space. So really, to protect against that kind of thing, we're talking about controlling what Wi-Fi clients can actually authenticate and associate to your access points.
Is that possible?
Indeed it is. I'm so glad you asked. It is possible with things like from what we have at WatchGuard, right? It's the wireless intrusion prevention system in our secure Wi-Fi package. It allows administrators to classify exactly the Wi-Fi clients that are allowed to connect to their APs, access points, and those that are not. It sounds kind of simple, right? But believe it or not, you know, if someone has the password to your Wi-Fi, how do you prevent them from connecting? You need something like like WIPs, wireless intrusion prevention, to actually deny that device from connecting. And equally, employees should only be connected to your Wi-Fi, right? Because you probably have network security policies, file permissions, things that you don't want your employees to bypass, right? And if an employee can easily bypass your whole network security while they're in the office, connected to like guest Wi-Fi or public Wi-Fi nearby, or even tethering to their hotspot on their cell phone, those are very common. I'll never admit to it, but maybe when I can't get to a certain website at work, I might tether to my cell phone and bypass that those firewall policies.
Ruh-roh.
Those are exactly the same kind of problem in the opposite direction, and WIPs can really stop those kinds of connections from happening and keep the traffic going through your corporate network.
Interesting. So WIPs, what is WIPs?
Yeah, I've mentioned that here a couple of times, Mark. WIPs stands for Wireless Intrusion Prevention System. It exists as a thing because it's on Wikipedia. That's how I live my life. But I'll tell you, WIPs is just a definition of software code algorithms running on Wi-Fi radios, access points, and it classifies threats. So everything we've talked about eavesdropping, you know, Wi-Fi connections, injecting packets into Wi-Fi connections, man-in-the-middle attacks. WIPs is the term for software code to detect those kinds of threats and even prevent them. The P stands for, you know, prevention.
It's not WIDS.
It's not WIDS, right? WIDS came first, wireless intrusion detection. And, you know, those kinds of systems, most every Wi-Fi vendor that you know around the business space offers some kind of WIPS, WIP system, but it's important to know they're not all implemented the same way. Just like we have different ways to catch malware, right? Not everybody has the same malware prevention method. There's different ways to do it. WatchGuard uses a quite different way, a patented way, to make sure that we're only preventing legitimate real attacks.
And that's an important distinction, right? Because if you get it wrong, it can be very bad for you.
Bad as in you get fined. Yes. Yeah. So you, me, anyone, your neighbors cannot block your Wi-Fi from working because Wi-Fi is an open standard. We're all supposed to be able to share it. So if somebody shuts down, meaning prevents you from connecting, that's illegal unless that shutdown is on a legitimate attack. It's a real man-in-the-middle attack. You're perfectly fine shutting that thing down.
And what's the fallout from getting it wrong? How big of fines are we talking here?
Oh, boy. Some that I've seen personally in the United States, and it varies by country, but it is worldwide. I've seen them north of $500,000 U.S. at a single violation.
That's rough.
That's rough.
That's real rough. So you don't want to get that wrong.
You don't want to get that wrong. You want to make sure your WIPs is accurate.
Well, thank you, Mr. Ryan Orsi, for sitting down for this chat. I appreciate you answering all the questions, and I'm sure we'll get some more, and hopefully we can pitch them your way in the future.
Awesome. It was a pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me.
See you around. Thanks again, everyone, for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions or suggestions for future episode topics, you can find me on Twitter at @XORRO_ and Corey @SecAdept. Thanks again. See you around.